Hello and welcome to Insight. My name is Ali, and with me, as she always is Charlie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am doing pretty good. There is a lot going on in our lives at the moment. We've both got podcasts besides Insight running. If you go to our Facebook group, you'll see all the information on our different podcasts, but Insight is still here. But before we get into today's case, we have some housekeeping.
I am going to be at CrimeCon with Insight Junior, and we will be on Podcasters Row. CrimeCon is in Nashville the first weekend in May. Tons of podcasters will be there, even the ones not on Podcasters Row. We are talking about doing all these meetups. It's going to be an amazing time. And for our listeners, if you use the code INSIGHT, you get 10% off your ticket for CrimeCon.
And that same weekend, I will be at the Australian Podcast Awards. Insight is nominated for the popular podcast category. So if you go to the show notes or to our Facebook page or group, there are details there how you can vote for us. Anna Jane Chaney was a successful and smart 28-year-old woman with her whole future ahead of her. She was getting married in 5 weeks' time to a man who she adored. But then, in March of 1994, Anna Jane was found drowned and naked in the bathtub of her home. Her alleged killer was her fiancé, 39-year-old divorced father of three, Henry Keogh. During the trial, he'll be accused of having at least two lengthy affairs and forging her signature on five secret insurance policies that totaled over $1 million. Anna Jane Chaney was born in March 1965 in Adelaide to a well-to-do family. Her father, Kevin, practiced haematology with the Institute of Medical and Veterinary Science and at the Adelaide's Women's and Children's Hospital. Her mother, Joanne, was a former nurse. Anna Jane attended a private school with her brother, Mark, Pembroke School, where she excelled and she was popular. By the time she was 14, Anna Jane knew she wanted to work in law, which she did. She went to Adelaide Law School in 1983, where again she excelled and finished at the top of her class. Our story then takes us to October of 1989. 24-year-old Anna Jane had just started working with a Thomas Simmons law firm, and she agreed to go out with her new work friends for Friday night drinks at the nearby Bull and Bear. And the Bull and Bear was known to be a popular hangout spot for lawyers and bankers, and it was situated in central Adelaide. At Bull and Bear the same night was a man who worked at the State Bank, which was located upstairs from the bar. 34-year-old Henry Keogh was also drinking with some friends. One of them were leaving the company, and it was kind of a farewell type of party.
Henry Keogh was born in Dublin, Ireland, and he had moved with his parents and two younger brothers to Australia when he was 13 years old. Henry came from a vastly different background than Anna. His father, Henry Sr., worked for a building company. His mother, Eileen, was a stay-at-home mom with a drinking problem. She would have violent fits of rage that would end with Eileen packing her bags and just threatening to leave the family. Henry Sr. would intervene, take her bags away, and she would still leave empty-handed. He'd chase after her, begging her to come back to the family. And this would play out over again. Eventually, this rage would turn physical toward the children, and Eileen would hit the children with whatever she had at hand, whether that was a belt or coat hanger or shoes, the ironing cord, whatever she could grab. It didn't matter to her as long as she could use the children as an outlet for her anger. Henry finished school and studied dentistry at Adelaide University. Like a lot of university or college students, life got in the way, and he tried studying part-time while he was working a series of casual jobs, you know, waiting tables, car salesman, those types of jobs. It all took its toll, though, and he ended up quitting university. He ended up selling insurance, and then selling dentistry equipment and pharmaceuticals. Eventually, he went back to university and became a financial planner and advisor. In 1988, he started working for the State Bank of South Australia as a financial consultant. Henry's personal life had been turbulent. When he was 15 years old in 1970, he met and started dating a fellow teen named Susan. By the time they were in their early 20s, they were married and had three daughters. All seemed to be going well at first. He was growing in his career and his family seemed okay, but by his early 30s, the cracks started appearing in the relationship. He was working for a pharmaceutical company, and his role in the company involved him traveling to Perth 3 or 4 times a year. During one particular business trip, Henry met a woman named Tracy, who was a divorced mother of two. They immediately started an affair. It got quite serious to the point that he considered leaving Susan. And Susan was getting increasingly suspicious of Henry's possible infidelity. However, eventually, Henry and Susan reconciled, and he broke off the affair with Tracy.
Because of this too, Henry changed jobs and started working as a financial planner. They bought a new house and got a fresh start. In the same year, Henry also joined the State Bank, and this brings us around full circle back to that Friday night in Adelaide at the Bull and Bear Bar with Anna-Jane Chaney. Now, the two hit it off right away. There was plenty of flirting and playful banter. Drinks at the bar moved to dinner at the restaurant, and even though the two weren't seated together at the table, they moved closer and continued to talk. After dinner, they went to a nightclub, and then the two went off alone for coffee. It would be around midnight that Anna-Jane and Henry went back to her place. According to Henry, all they did was talk until around 3 in the morning, at which time he left. He claims he told her that night that he was separated and that he had 3 children with his ex-wife. The reality is, though, is he was very much still married to Susan, and they were very much still living together in their family home. Anna-Jane immediately fell for Henry. From her point of view, he was mature and intelligent, and she wanted to tell the world about their relationship. From Henry's point of view, though, he wasn't looking for a serious relationship. Anna-Jane wasn't his type. But after 2 months of casual sexual encounters, things became more serious. However, Henry's circumstances were vastly more complicated than Anna-Jane's, and their relationship meant that Henry had to live a double life. Friday nights would involve him staying with Anna. He would then lie to Susan and tell her he was staying at the office or going away on business. On one occasion, the bank sent him away for 2 weeks for a conference, but he told Susan it was for 3, and he spent the 3rd week at Anna-Jane's place. This went on for about a year and a half. In September of 1990, Henry bought an investment property with a colleague. Not long after this, they rented the house to Anna-Jane and 2 of her friends. By this point, Henry's marriage was deteriorating at a rapid rate. He was neglecting his wife and children. He'd actually openly told Susan he was having an affair. Susan had had enough, and Henry moved into the investment property with Anna-Jane and her friends.
Anna-Jane's parents, Kevin and Joanne, were not happy with their daughter's choice of a partner. Here was a man who started off the relationship with their daughter as a married man, and now he was a soon-to-be-divorced man with 3 young children to support, as well as being significantly older than her. Having the social standing the Chaney family had, he also wasn't a man in a job that was professionally respectable enough for Anna-Jane to be involved with. I mean, in short, he wasn't good enough for her. This caused a source of friction between the couple. Henry would reassure her that he was going through with the divorce process and they could get married and progress in their relationship when the divorce went through. Anna Jane got impatient, though, and she didn't entirely trust him, so she did a search of the family law court records, only to find that there were no papers lodged. It looked like no one had actually filed for divorce.
And that sends alarm bells in my head. If she didn't trust him that much at that point, it showed the relationship wasn't healthy.
Right. With trust being very important to a relationship that she thought she had to check up on him in this, it was a good sign she probably was not in a good relationship. This finding out that it appeared the papers hadn't been filed, that caused further issues between Anna Jane's parents and Henry. They already thought he wasn't good enough for her, and now he's lying to her. But the fact was, Henry did lodge the papers, but they were missing a signature, so they were returned to the address listed, which was his mother's house. And his mother, Eileen, was vehemently against divorce. So she ripped up the documents and threw them away and never told Henry anything. Because of all of this, they decided that Eileen wouldn't even be invited to the wedding. Anna Jane's mother wasn't interested in going either. She only tolerated Henry because of her love for her daughter. But regardless, in November of 1992, Anna Jane and Henry made their engagement official and told all of their friends. Anna Jane was excited to finally become his wife, but Henry didn't seem actually that happy with that arrangement. He wasn't looking forward to being married again, especially so soon after ending his previous 15-year marriage. Henry didn't keep these reservations from Anna. He told her he wasn't sure if the marriage was the right decision for them right then. And he didn't want any more children. And that would be a consideration for him, knowing that he was taking a younger wife who hadn't had any children yet. But he had had a vasectomy, and he had no intention of getting it reversed. He didn't want to take away Anna Jane's chance to become a mother, but she told him he was just being silly. It was normal to be nervous about getting married again, especially with the less than positive experience with marriage before, and also that she didn't want children. She was happy to focus on their careers and their life together without adding children to the mix.
We just need to take a short break for a word about one of our sponsors this week, Simple Contacts.
I wear contact lenses, and the worst thing for me about wearing contact lenses is those annual appointments that I have to make just to renew my contact lens prescription. My insurance does not cover those, so they get pretty expensive. So I was really excited to hear about Simple Contacts and give that a try. I'm not really great with technology, I've said it before, and so when I was told it would only take 5 minutes and I could do it from my computer or from an app on my phone, I doubted it would take me only 5 minutes, but it did. It took me only 5 minutes. I can't drive to my doctor's appointment in 5 minutes. I can't even get around to making the phone call in 5 minutes. This really simplified the process for me. And the vision test was only $20. Compared to my annual appointment cost, you can't beat that. And the contact lens prices are also unbeatable. Trust me, I've shopped around. Standard shipping is free. And best of all, they are offering a promotion to our listeners. If you go to simplecontacts.com/insight, promo code insight, you will get $30 off your contacts. This is not a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam, but it's designed by doctors, and licensed ophthalmologists review every test carefully to make sure your eyes look healthy and that your vision hasn't changed. So go to simplecontacts.com/insight, promo code insight, to get that $30 off your contacts. This is vision care simplified.
The last day of Anna Jane's life began normally, By March 18 of 1994, Henry and Anna Jane were just 5 weeks out from their wedding, and they were living together in a new apartment in McGill, which they were able to buy thanks to a $30,000 loan from Anna Jane's father. And again, this caused tension between Henry and the Cheneys. They thought that he wasn't adding anything in the way of financially supporting their daughter. But on March 18, 1994, Henry and Anna Jane both left for work as per usual at 8 a.m. Anna Jane was wearing a two-piece grey business suit, but her day wasn't smoothly running though. She'd been recently promoted, and as part of her new role, she was responsible for organising a raid on another lawyer's office who was suspected for committing fraud. This raid was carried out a week earlier, and the lawyer involved claimed that there was no search warrant, which meant that any files seized were taken illegally. In the end, though, none of this matters, because the lawyer in question was later convicted for fraud and perjury, and was eventually struck off as a lawyer for quite a number of years. But on this day, he had 3 heated telephone conversations with Anna Jane. That morning, Anna Jane also met with a friend, Sarah Teller, for coffee. Sarah and Anna Jane used to work together and they remained close friends. Sarah would later report that Anna Jane was in a happy and positive mood that morning. She was excited to talk about her upcoming wedding. She also mentioned that she was meeting with Henry that evening after work for drinks to celebrate her 29th birthday, which was 2 weeks earlier. Sarah spoke to Anna Jane again later that afternoon and everything still seemed fine. And then at 4:30 p.m, Anna Jane's best friend, Lucinda Rue, dropped by her work to tell her that she wouldn't be meeting the couple for the drinks because she had other plans. The two spoke a bit about the wedding and then Lucinda left. That night about 5:40, Henry arrived at the Norwood Hotel. At that point, Anna Jane had already finished a glass of Chardonnay. The two had a brief fight after Henry claimed that the barman gave her the house wine, and Anna Jane was mad because she said she would know the difference. It was just a silly fight that the two soon got over. The couple stayed at the pub for a little over an hour. They ate some potato fries, with Henry drinking 3 glasses of wine and Anna Jane drinking at least 4 on top of the one she had before Henry arrived.
They both drove home in separate cars and arrived back at their McGill home at about 7 p.m. Henry changed out of his work clothes and decided to do some studying for a management course he was taking at the time. In the meantime, Anna Jane called her sister-in-law Sue and arranged to meet her at the park to walk their dogs later in the evening. So Anna Jane changed into green track pants and a striped blouse and sneakers and drove to Sue's place, where they then drove to the park together. Sue later reported their conversation was unremarkable, but she said there was alcohol on Anna Jane's breath, though she didn't seem drunk. They stayed at the park for about half an hour and then went back home. According to Henry's testimony, Anna Jane returned home at about 8 p.m. They talked about their wedding plans for a while, and this brought up the subject of Henry's mother and whether or not she was going to attend. Anna Jane asked him, had he changed his mind on this? And then she lectured him a bit for not visiting his mother for more than a month. So Henry said, okay, he'd leave then and go visit his mother. She only lived a suburb over, so it's not like it was a lot to go out on this visit. Anna Jane told him that she was tired and had a sore back, so while he was gone, she was going to take a bath. This was pretty typical, part of her routine. Anna Jane was very fond of taking baths. In fact, when she would look at houses or places to rent, she would look at the size of the bathtub. It was a deal breaker for her. Henry later reported that he left the McGill home around 8:30 to visit his mother. And if this is to be believed, that would be the last time he would see Anna Jane alive. leaving at 8:30. He got to his mother's house about 8:35. He stayed for 45 minutes doing one of those obligatory visits and left around 9:20. When he got home, it would have only been a few minutes later, he was greeted at the door by their dog, but there was no sign of Anna Jane. He called out to her, but she didn't answer. The outside light was off, so he knew she wasn't out in the yard or watering their plants or anything like that. He called out again. She didn't respond. On a quick walkthrough of the house, he noticed the bathroom light was on, but he didn't really think anything of it because Anna Jane had a habit of leaving lights on throughout the house. So it didn't mean she was in there. It just meant she had been in there. So he checked the living area, the kitchen, the bedroom, the places he thought he'd find her, but he didn't.
Now, the bathroom had two entries. It could be accessed from the hallway or as an ensuite from the bedroom. On this night, though, Henry entered through the hallway and immediately saw Anna Jane slumped and naked in the bath. The first thing that Henry reports as remembering seeing is the bluish hue in her skin and her open glassy eyes. She was facing towards the bedroom and was slumped on her right side with her mouth and nose submerged under the water. Henry later reported running over to her and pulling her up so her head was above the water. He tried to slip his arms under her body and lift her out of the way, but he had an injury to his back. That and the awkwardness of the manoeuvre, plus the slipperiness of the skin because of the water, it meant that he couldn't get her out of the bathtub. He then tried to pull the plug out of the bath, but again couldn't because Anna Jane's body was covering it. Eventually, though, he was able to pull her out by her arms into the bedroom. All the while, Anna Jane didn't make any sounds or movements. Henry later reported then checking Anna Jane's pulse by placing his fingers on her throat. At first, he thinks he feels something. He tried the other side of her throat and felt nothing. It would later be determined that Anna Jane would already have been dead at this point, and chances are, if he indeed felt something, he was probably feeling his own increased pulse rate. Henry had once been a volunteer with the ambulance service, and he was fully qualified in delivering first aid, so he acted accordingly. He tried to clear her airway as best he could. He pinched her nose and proceeded with mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, followed by chest compressions. Water did emerge from her mouth, but no vital signs were evident. Henry knew this wasn't helping, so he put Anna Jane into the recovery position and ran to call 000 emergency services at 9:30. And while they were on their way, Henry resumed CPR. The paramedics arrived soon after. They later report that Henry appeared to be distressed and panicked, that he was hunched over Anna Jane's body and crying. The paramedics went to work trying to save her. They ventilated her and immediately fluid and vomit came out of her mouth. On their final report, they noted there was significant blockage to her airway. But all their efforts were unsuccessful and Anna Jane was declared legally dead. It was also noticed there was no blood or vomit in the bathtub. The bathwater was still full of water and it was lukewarm. At least 10 police officers were quick to arrive on the scene, but finding an accurate account of this next sequence of events is difficult. Very little notes were kept. Most of the witness statements were taken months after Anna Jane had died, and there was a severe lack of adequate details in these statements. For example, the Chaneys were interviewed for their witness statements well after Henry had been charged with murder. But before the police left, the general consensus was that her death had been an unfortunate accident, but this would soon change. The autopsy was carried out 2 days later by Dr. Colin Maddock. His first assessment of the death was that it was not suspicious and that the cause of death was drowning. He noted that there was a small bruise on top of Anna Jane's head that appeared to have occurred shortly before her death. He noted that she was young and healthy, and there were no obvious signs why she had drowned. that diagnosis of exclusion occurs when working out why someone dies in this situation. That while it is possible that someone suffered from a heart attack or anaphylactic fit, which would bring on a sudden loss of consciousness and ultimately death, there's usually some sort of evidence of this prior to the death. And that aside from an accident, underlying disease or medical condition, drugs or alcohol, that can all play a role. But there was no reason why the body could not be released to the family. They had no reason to think this was anything suspicious. Now, the problem with this is that if anything came up later, which we will see happen in this case, there would be no evidence. During the autopsy, no colour photographs were taken, nor were there any photographs of the whole body to confirm that this was indeed the autopsy of Anna Jane. We just need to take a short break for a word about our other sponsor this week, Unexplained Mysteries. If you are a fan of Insight, you probably enjoy mysteries, right? Well, let me tell you about a new podcast I love called Unexplained Mysteries. Every week, the hosts explore the greatest mysteries of the past and present, from the building of Stonehenge to the subject of Mona Lisa. There may not be a simple answer or explanation, but that doesn't mean that there isn't an explanation at all. And with a team of investigators, these hosts dig deep using in-depth research and analysis as they look for answers on Earth's greatest mysteries. Each episode uses captivating and unique storytelling to take you on a journey. And with a new episode out every Thursday, you can expect upcoming episodes on crop circles, dragons, and many more. Visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts and search for Unexplained Mysteries. Again, that's UnexplainedMysteries. Or visit parcast.com/unexplained and start listening now. That's parcast, P-A-R-C-A-S-T, .com/unexplained to listen now.
However, the investigators did not necessarily agree with the coroner's findings. They thought that the bruise was inconsistent with an accident and set forth to interview Anna Jane's family. Anna Jane's brother Mark and his wife were interviewed first, and they openly told of their disapproval of Henry. They described his and Anna Jane's relationship as turbulent, which would be fair. They had broken up several times, and Henry was possessive. They also fought quite a bit over little things. They thought it was unusual that he didn't tell his mother of Anna Jane's passing until the next day, and that he stayed at the couple's house in spite of numerous offers for him to stay with other people. Most people don't want to stay in the house where their significant other had just died. That's not everybody. You know, we don't like to judge how people react to grief, but this stood out to Mark and his wife. The investigators' insistence that something more nefarious happened also carried across to the coroner. The report was amended to include small bruise marks, like a grip mark, around Anna Jane's left ankle. From this, Manek developed what is called his grip theory. He theorized that Henry slipped his hand under Anna Jane's legs and gripped the left leg from just above the ankle. His theory went that Henry then pulled his victim forward so that she slipped under the water, and while doing so, he forced his legs over her head, drowning her. This theory was inspired by the Brides in the Bath murders that occurred in Blackpool, England, in the early part of the 20th century. Three women were murdered, drowned in small baths by the same man, George Joseph Smith. He had married and murdered each woman in quick succession, each time changing his name and taking out insurance on his victims. But thanks to the development of modern forensic pathology, he was caught. Despite the lack of injuries, there were slight bruises in the shape of a handprint on their arms. Investigators came to the conclusion that all three had been pulled by the legs, causing an upsurge of water into their nose, which rendered them unconscious and incapable of struggling. Smith then held down his victims by their arms. It took a jury just 20 minutes to reach a guilty verdict, and he was hanged in prison in 1915. He would later be given the name in the media as the Bathtub Bluebeard.
Now, Henry visited the Cheneys early the following week to arrange Anna Jane's funeral and her finances, and Henry allegedly said that she had no insurance policies that he knew of. By the end of the week, however, this changed. Henry visited the Cheneys again, and he now recalled that she had taken out a $400,000 insurance policy before they went on their Southeast Asian holiday. And at the same time, he had taken out an even larger policy on Anna Jane for an additional $700,000. But he wasn't exactly hiding this fact. Around the same time, he handed over to the investigators a total of 10 life insurance policies. Three of these totaled around $730,000. The other two significant policies covered both Anna Jane's and Henry's lives and amounted to around $700,000. There were two other policies on her life, and between them, they came to a further $400,000. What Henry didn't disclose, though, was that the signatures on the latter two policies were forged, that he had signed Anna Jane's name and not her. He explained the large number of policies was because he was working as an insurance agent for five different companies, because he was concerned about the stability at his current job. And to keep his role with these insurance companies, he had to take out these policies. Now, I looked into this, and this is apparently normal for insurance brokers. And Henry insisted that Anna Jane knew about these policies, but just didn't actually sign for them herself. At about 9:10 p.m. on March 23, 1994, two investigators knocked on Henry's door and requested that he go to the police station to give a formal statement. And that this wasn't an option, he had to do it, because technical service officers were on their way to the McGill home to forensically search the house, as in the case with suspicious deaths. They were to check for any signs of a break-in in order to test the possibility that someone else could have been present at the time of Anna Jane's death. And if this wasn't the case, if there was no chance that anyone else could be present in the house, then Henry could be the only suspect.
Anna Jane's body was finally released to the family and her funeral was held a week later. A month after the funeral, Manick released his final autopsy report. He made pointed reference to the bruises on her ankle and those being somehow related to her death. He also made an observation that there was no bruising to her brain. And to him, that was critical. In his view, if Anna Jane had slipped and struck her head, causing her to fall unconscious in the bath and drown, I mean, that would have been a pretty hard hit. Then her brain would show some signs of bruising. But there was nothing of the sort. And therefore, to Manick, that meant she had to have been conscious during her drowning. This report intensified the investigators' attention on Henry. They were convinced that money was the primary motive for murder. They speculated that the insurance policies that were taken out on Anna Jane were all part of a premeditated plan that was a year in the making to murder her. This all led to May 7th, 1994, when Henry was approached during his daughter's basketball game and arrested for the murder of Anna Jane Cheney. Henry applied for bail, but it was refused. He was remanded into custody to appear at trial, but no trial date was set at the time. Investigators continued to dig for information for the future trial, and they found some inflammatory information. Not only was Henry allegedly still sleeping with his ex-wife, but two young women came forward independently of each other, claiming that they too had affairs with Henry during his relationship with Anna Jane. Henry's lawyer would argue that this was not relevant at all. In fact, it was prejudicial to his case. Henry had admitted to Anna Jane of having the affair with one of the women more than a year before she died, and that this affair was during a time the two were actually separated, so it wasn't relevant to his guilt or innocence in this case. But the stories from the women were as follows. The first woman, Woman A, said that she worked for the same company as Henry, and that during the first 15 to 20 minutes of their first meeting, he asked her out. Now, Henry denied that this ever happened. He said that Woman A asked him for advice with her love life. He admitted they exchanged Christmas gifts, and on Valentine's Day, which was a month before Anna Jane's death, he personally delivered a rose with a card. According to Woman A, this card read that they belonged together.
Woman B was the woman that Henry did not deny having the affair with. They worked for partnering companies and met during a series of meetings and hit it off. That she was aware that he had been married and had children. That by the end of 1991, they were meeting outside of work for dinner and drinks. In March of 1992, Henry tells Woman B that he had ended his relationship with Anna Jane, which according to the timeline of their relationship, that's true. Although he allegedly did tell Woman B that Anna Jane was the woman he wanted to marry. By June, Woman B and Henry's relationship had turned sexual, and that continued until the end of the year. It was then that Woman B broke off the relationship because Henry refused to spend the night at her house. The reason he gave her was because of his back injury. He complained that her bed was too soft. He also said that he was an early riser and didn't want to disturb her. He then changed that to that he was still in love with Anna Jane and wasn't ready to commit to another serious relationship.
Henry's first trial began on February 13th of 1995. The prosecution would call 47 witnesses and the defense would call just three. For just a comparison, in the second trial that would be held in August of the same year, spoiler alert, the prosecution would increase to 55 witnesses and the defense just five. The star witnesses for the prosecution were Woman A and Woman B and the Cheney family, and of course the coroner, Dr. Colin Manick. The prosecution would argue that Henry was a heartless opportunist, that he never wanted to marry or be with Anna Jane, and that lack of commitment resulted in his scheme to murder her for over $1 million in these phony insurance policies. The defense would argue that just because Henry cheated on Anna Jane and had that affair, it didn't make him a murderer. There was ample evidence that Anna Jane did know about all of the policies, and that it couldn't be reasonably discounted that Anna Jane slipped after several glasses of wine, hit her head, and tragically drowned. Manick insisted that at no time was he happy that the death was accidental. He testified that there was no evidence that Anna Jane had fallen asleep or fainted or slipped. Instead, he made critical observation of the bruises and how they came to get on Anna Jane's leg. He made a grip with his own hand and claimed this showed the same position as the bruises on her leg. He claimed that Henry would have pulled her leg through the water, causing water to rapidly run up her nose, rendering her unconscious.
Next was the testimony of Woman A and Woman B. Woman B was first, and that is the affair that Henry admits to. He described their relationship as fairly intense. That Woman B insisted that they were boyfriend and girlfriend, but he claims that this was just a fantasy she made up and that what she said was fabricated. Woman A claimed that Henry and her planned numerous weekends away together, only for him to make up outrageous excuses that had no grounding in reality, such as his daughter went missing or that he had this brilliant new job. Now that, as we have mentioned in other episodes, accused persons are not obliged to testify on their own behalf in court, but Henry chose to take the stand. He claimed that he never intended to hide the insurance policies from anyone, and that the lapse in memory was due to the shock of finding his fiancée dead in the bath. He also didn't deny having an affair with woman B, and he didn't deny forging Anna Jane's signature on the insurance policies. After a month, the jury retired on March 10, 1995. After 24 hours, they sent a message that they were deadlocked and that there was no chance of breaking that deadlock. They were given additional time to see if they could come to an agreement, but only an hour later, the jury again sent a note saying that they couldn't break the deadlock and there would be no verdict. Another trial would have to be held.
The defense immediately wanted an appeal and applied to the court, pleading that, with the amount of media attention surrounding the case, there would be no way there was going to be an unbiased jury in South Australia, and that the charges should be permanently stayed. This application was rejected, and the trial was moved instead. And that instead of having a week between the first and second trials, there would actually be a four-month break, and Henry could then be released on bail. The second trial began on August 8th of 1995. The argument here was pretty much the same as the first trial. The prosecution again argued that the existence of the five policies that valued over $1 million was grounds for motive. And the sum on each of the policies was just conveniently set below the threshold required for Anna Jane to have to take a medical examination. And that was proof, more proof, that Henry is keeping these policies secret from Anna Jane. The defense argued that there's no way to tell if the bruises on her legs were done shortly before death because it's simply impossible to tell the true age of a bruise. Following just over 2 weeks of evidence, the jury again retired, and 5 hours later, they had reached their decision. They found Henry guilty of the murder of Anna Jane. The defense immediately notified the court of their intention to appeal, and Henry remained in the city's remand center as sentencing was postponed once after his conviction and again because of the initial appeal bid. Finally, in February of 1996, Henry was sentenced to one of the heaviest penalties imposed in South Australia at the time of 25 years with no parole. For his appeal, the defense cited four grounds: the admissibility of Woman A and Woman B's evidence, the media attention surrounding their stories against Henry was causing unfair and prejudicial reporting in the case. Now, all counts on the appeal were dismissed and the verdict stood.
The route forward through the justice system after this was to apply for special leave to appeal to the High Court, which is really the last step you can do. You really don't have anywhere to go after that. Very few cases actually make it through this step. Henry's only other remote avenue was to petition for mercy to the governor, and this gives the government the power to pardon someone of a serious conviction if compelling new evidence comes to light that proves their innocence. And the compelling new evidence is a part that does come up again later. Only one of two petitions for mercy to the governor have ever been successful in South Australia. What is generally requested by petitioners is not a pardon, but to have their case allowed back in court for a retrial. And this is exactly what Henry was hoping for when he made his first petition back in December 17, 1996. And because of the uncertainty of the High Court, this appeared to be his best option at this point. The rejection of Henry's first petition 3 months later was purely procedural. He didn't cover all the steps necessary that you had to do before you can petition. Move forward to November 1999, and more people were looking into this case as the defence was preparing for their next petition. They asked Professor Tony Thomas, who was an expert in tissue sampling and pathology, to have a look at the tissue samples taken from Anna Jane's body.
Professor Thomas was surprised by the lack of samples available. What he found were four samples taken from the bruise, two from heart tissue, one from the lungs, and one from the kidneys. What was missing, though, were samples from the brain, the liver, the pancreas, etc. He found that strange considering that the prosecution argued that Anna Jane was healthy and that healthy people don't drown in their own bathtubs. But how could we be certain of that without blood samples from vital organs? In his report, he likened Anna Jane's death to another case he had been involved in 1996. At around 7:20 on June 8th of 1996, Jody Louise Ryan was found drowned in her bathtub by her roommate. Like Anna Jane, the bathwater was still lukewarm. This was unexpected. Jody was healthy. She was a former state champion swimmer. However, foul play was ruled out, and she was found to have a blood alcohol level of 0.13. It was ruled during an inquest that Jody had fallen asleep while taking an early morning hot bath after a night out drinking with friends. And what this shows is that drinking and taking a hot bath was a dangerous combination in Jody's case. But could it also have been the same with Anna Jane?
In 2001, when Henry was only a quarter through his sentence, Four Corners, which is an investigative type program in Australia, they did an episode on Henry's sentence and challenged the forensics used. And this was a bombshell. Professor Thomas was interviewed and talked about the tissue sample taken from the bruise. He said that when he looked under the microscope, all he could see was fatty tissue and not broken blood cells, which is what leads to a bruise. What Professor Thomas was saying is that the jury was misinformed during the trial about Mannock's main theory, and if this was correct, the absence of the bruise meant there was no tangible evidence to place anyone else in the bathroom when Anna Jane died. This led to an independent reenactment of what happened that night in the McGill bathroom. And it was carried out by a local newspaper, the Sunday Mail, in December of 2001. The article concluded that the theorised drowning proposed in the trial was unlikely to have happened because of the bathroom layout. The article was also not complimentary of Mannock and his methods either. The letters to the editor column the next week was filled with angry readers and family and friends of Anna Jane. Dr. Mannock then sued the newspaper for defamation, knowing that he had the majority of public opinion behind him.
The defense then turned their attention to the insurance policies and the likelihood that Anna Jane actually knew about them. This was a huge part of the prosecution's case. The most telling piece of evidence in the Anna Jane knew about the insurance policies column is two personal loan applications that she lodged in November 1993 and March 1994. On these applications, she had included an amount of $36 per week, which was the premium for all of the insurance policies combined. Another tick in the column was from Henry's ex-wife, who said that during their marriage, Henry had been responsible for all of the family finances, and doing so, from time to time, he would sign her name on her behalf. Yes, this is illegal, but it's what they did because it was easier. And that makes it possible that this was negotiated in his relationship with Anna Jane as well. The third piece of evidence that supported that Anna Jane knew about the policies came in a statement from one of the couple's mutual friends. And this was from July of 1993. Henry and Anna Jane went to a friend's house for dinner. They started talking about vacations, and that talk turned into talking about travel insurance. During this conversation, Anna Jane let it slip out in frustration that she and Henry already had insurance totaling over $2 million combined. The subject was quickly dropped. No one mentioned it after, but the couple remembered that she had mentioned that.
Things took another turn in December of 2002 when a new state forensic pathologist was assigned, Dr. Alan Carler. A year later, he was asked to look at Henry's case for retrial on behalf of the prosecution, and he put together a six-page report. In this report, he damned the findings of Professor Thomas, saying that he had no place to comment on the case because he wasn't a forensic pathologist, but a quote-unquote competent cardiac pathologist, and that he believed that there was bruising in the tissue sample. He went on to say that the reenactment in the Sunday Mail was quote-unquote poorly constructed, scientifically unsound, and proved nothing. Progress was slow on the petition front, and two more petitions would be submitted and rejected. It wouldn't be until June of 2005 that there would be another major occurrence in the case. The medical board released a scathing report on Dr. Maddock and his practices, of his unprofessional conduct working on the case, and that the autopsy on Anna Jane was incompetent. Anna Jane's case would not be the only one that would question Maddock's procedures. One other case that was highlighted was in a case that was named the baby's deaths in the media. This case involved three infants that had died in separate incidents in 1992 and 1993, which eventually led to a coronial inquiry in 1994. Baby Joshua Nottel had suffered 15 fractured ribs, extensive bruising, and a broken spine by the time he died at 9 months old. Storm Dean had two possible skull fractures and four broken ribs. William Bernard had a broken arm that had been left untreated for up to 4 weeks, an extensive nappy rash. Yet Manock had concluded that the cause of death in each case was due to a basic inflammatory disease. In the medical board inquiry, it was noted that some of Manock's explanations under oath had been reckless, incorrect, or otherwise unacceptable.
14 months after the medical board published its decision, Henry was granted his right to appeal. It would take another 12 months before the appeal was decided. They deemed that although Maddock was unprofessional in his conduct, according to the medical board, that didn't affect what happened with the tests. And as far as the state was concerned, Dr. Maddock's conduct in performing the autopsy on Anna Jane was satisfactory. By this point, Henry had been held in maximum security prison for more than 10 years. It was at this point that appealing to the High Court was really his only option left. His last petition was rejected, stating that there was no fresh and compelling evidence to move forward with a retrial. Henry's full bench appeal was set down for September 2014, which he did not attend. For the defense, they called Professor Pounder, who had worked with Dr. Maddock previously. And he was internationally renowned. He had previously consulted for the United Nations on torture and deaths in custody and worked with the International Criminal Court. Professor Pounder said that he believed the bruise to Anna Jane's head wasn't from hitting the bathtub, but that it was caused by Maddock himself when he was reflecting the scalp. Professor Pounder advised that these injuries were easily sustained during this process because of the sensitive nature of the skin in this part of the body. He also testified that it was impossible to tell if a bruise was caused by a blow or a fall, and to rule out one or the other just because it didn't fit with a particular scenario, and to do so would be foolish and not the place of a pathologist. The prosecution argued that there is nothing new nor compelling that showed a substantial miscarriage of justice. This process was delayed more because the prosecution wanted an additional 4 weeks to consider if they wished to recall one of the defense's expert pathologists, but this never happened. It was the ruling of the High Court not to call Dr. Maddock or his successor, Dr. James, to defend the evidence they had given to the two trials previously. Instead, they called two other former head pathologists to give their opinion of the tissue samples and the evidence, and they too testified there was nothing in the evidence to determine that this was in fact a homicide over an accidental death.
Expectations were obviously high. These types of complex cases generally take 4, 5, even 6 months for a judgment to be passed down. So it came to a surprise to everyone when the word came that the judgment would be passed down only 2 months later, on December 17, 2014. There was standing room only in the courtroom. The High Court had prepared a 53-page judgment in record time that ruled that the request for appeal was granted. The conviction of Henry for Anna Jane's murder was set aside and he would be retried. After 20 years in prison, Henry would be released before Christmas. He walked out of the courthouse, arm in arm with both of his daughters, as a free man. On November 13, 2015, there was an announcement to be made. Both the prosecution and the defence were ordered to attend court to discuss the matter of a retrial. It was the prosecution that had a bombshell in the case that this time would work in Henry's favour. They wanted to announce that due to an essential witness becoming unwell and not being able to give evidence, they would be discontinuing the prosecution and would not be proceeding with a third trial. This witness, it was Dr. Colin Maddock. In July 2004, Henry's mother, Eileen, died at age 70. Despite their rocky relationship, Henry adored his mother. In the months before her death, she was interviewed by a news program, and she spoke about the impact that Henry's conviction had on her and her family. She had suffered a nervous breakdown and felt alienated by the community, saying that she was known as that murderer's mother by the people around her. Eileen always believed that Anna Jane's death was a tragic accident, and she never thought that her son was responsible. Despite some uproar in the public, Henry was allowed to attend his mother's funeral and delivered the eulogy in handcuffs.
In 2009, Henry met a woman. Faye Hambor was recently separated and was talking with a friend about miscarriages of justice, and she was drawn to the case. She wanted to know what she could do to help. Knowing that the justice system isn't as reliable as you think it is, that's life-shattering. She ended up volunteering to help on Henry's legal team. She carried files and the like. She started visiting him, wanting to know from him his side of the story. They started corresponding outside of that. In 2009, a further appeal to the medical board echoed the first and hit him hard, and Henry leaned on Faye to get him through yet another blow to his freedom. Faye wasn't looking for love in prison, but through working together and talking about his life and then her life, they fell in love, and the two married in April of 2016.